For no hope for the lazy, for they will not find eternal rest. However, through traveling within yourselves, you will discover the unity of your consciousness with other consciousnesses. You will discover the multidimensional love and energy that gives consciousness to all things. This will not lead you to want to rest upon the proverbial blessed bosom. It will instead inspire you to take a better hand in the job of creation, and that feeling of divine presence you will find indeed, and feel indeed, for you will sense it behind the dance of the molecules, and in yourselves and in your neighbors. What so many want is a God who walks down the street and says, "Happy Sunday, I am I, follow me." But God is hidden craftily in his creations, so that he is what they are, and they are what he is. And in knowing them, you know him.
Break and discussion.
Now, there are many words for psychological time. I do not mean my method of meditation alone. I do mean subjective activity on your part and exploration. Do you follow me? I am glad. Actually, you are with God now. It is you who do not realize this. You see, you have believed many tales, and symbolically, they were very important. As was mentioned earlier, they have their place in your lives and your development, but there are times when you must leave them behind, and you may feel lonesome for a while without them.
Question. Then we need those beliefs as part of our development, even though we cast them off later?
Yes, even though someone like myself will come along and take off the comfort blankets, for after a while they hamper your development, where earlier they helped you grow. The fact remains, however, you do not have to die to find God. All that is now, and you are a part of all that is now. As I have told you often, you are a spirit now. The avenues for development are open now. You can now set out to explore environments that are not physical if you want to, but I do not see any rush of students at that invisible door. Now I am going to close our session, but I would like you all to read carefully a copy of what I have said. And now and then, when you have nothing else to do, nothing better to do, then try. Try to sense that lapse in the pulsation of your consciousness. Try to leap that gap. I bid you all good evening.
11:25 p.m. Jane Roberts ESP class session before June 23rd, 1970. This remnant, saved by one of Jane's students, is all that is left from one of the few class sessions that were either lost or not fully recorded. See Chapter 9.
True spirituality is a thing of joy and of the earth, and has nothing to do with fake adult dignity. It has nothing to do with long words and sorrowful faces. It has to do with the dance of consciousness that is within you, and with the sense of spiritual adventure that is within your hearts. That is the meaning of spirituality. And as I have told you before, if I could, I would do a merry dance about the room to show you that your vitality is not dependent upon a physical image. It is not dependent upon your youth. It is not dependent upon your body. It rings and sings through the universe and through your entire personality. It is a sense of joy that makes all creativity probable. So do not think you are being spiritual when you are being long-faced, and do not think you are being spiritual when you berate yourself for your sins. The seasons within your system come and go. The sun falls upon your face whether you think you are a sinner or a saint. The vitality of the universe is creativity and joy and love, and that is spirituality. and that is what I shall tell the readers of my book. And now, take the break I promised you.
Session 558, November 5th, 1970, 9:50 p.m. Thursday. This excerpt from the session contains Seth's first mention of the speakers and their functions in the reincarnational process, and supplements the speaker data in Chapter 17. The session came about because Ron B. and his wife Grace, members of ESP class, requested help with a problem involving their family. After winding up some very interesting material concerning that situation, Seth launched into the speaker data at about 11:15. All of us present were surprised. The term speaker, as Seth uses it, was as unknown to Jane and me then as it was to Ron and his family.
We have known several people who were monks in a previous existence. Now,
to Ron,
in a life in the East before the time of Christ, 1200 BC, you were a member of a body of men who belonged to an esoteric heritage. You were wanderers and traveled also through Asia Minor. You carried with you in your heads messages and laws that had been given to you of your kind in a time that was already nearly forgotten. These were codes of ethics. They originated from the time of Atlantis. Before that, these codes were given by a race from another star. This race had to do with the origin of Atlantis. The messages were put into words and language and written down at the time of Atlantis, but after that they were handed down by word of mouth. Your people learned them from their elders, and they were called speakers. You were a speaker. This is why you find it so easy to call others your brothers. Now, three men in particular who are under you
in the manufacturing plant where Ron holds a supervisor's position
were part of that original band of men. Your wife, your daughter-in-law, and your son,
all present this evening,
were also members of that band. Your wife and your daughter-in-law, however, were brothers. Now, give us a moment here.
Pause.
You traveled through Asia Minor in a time of great turmoil, and wherever you went, you spoke, which means you gave utterance to the ethics. It took you 12 years of training to memorize this code of ethics. Now later, the Essenes were involved. I am not sure of the word.
The Essenes were one of the four known Jewish sects active in the Holy Land at the time of Christ. They were a peaceful, contemplative group. They aren't mentioned in the Bible. If Seth means that the Essenes were promulgating the speakers' codes of ethics in, say, the first century A.D., then this, of course, is a time many centuries later than Ron's life in 1200 B.C. Ron's wife, Grace. Seth, did we fulfill our purposes in that time?
In that existence, yes. You must give me time. There was turmoil within the group, disagreement. There was disagreement over the meaning of the words that were recalled. The group became divided. One portion of the group traveled to the land we now call Palestine, and the other migrated in the next century, appearing in southern Europe. There was a major distortion having to do with B-A-E-L, a group gathered together with Baal as their idea of God. You,
Ron,
were in the other group. There was a city in a jungle, M-E-S-S-I-N-I, as nearly as I can translate it. In Asia Minor, and fragments of a past civilization were then there. A new city was built, which in turns also disappeared. There were writings on rocks, however, as the old messages were once again put into written symbols, but your people were gone, and you are only now finding them again.
11:27. Jane's trance had been very good. She had trouble opening her eyes, then in keeping them open. She had seen images while giving the material, she said, but couldn't describe them to us now. 10 sessions after this one, Seth told Jane and me that we had been speakers also, although he said nothing about dates or countries or whether Jane, Ron, or I might be renewing acquaintances made in other, perhaps very ancient times. It seems to me that in this life at least, Ron and I encountered each other in quite a strange way. Almost of an age, we grew up in the same small town near Elmira many years ago. We knew of each other's family, and yet we didn't meet until 1970. Possibly reflecting his early speaker practices, which may be continuing on subjective levels, Ron is active in lay church work and knows much about the Bible and related subjects. He elaborated upon some of Seth's data. Later, I checked portions through various reference works. Jane, since she knows practically nothing about the historical periods in question, was very pleased that Seth's data was so evocative. Seth Jane spelled the god's name B-A-E-L, Baal. Most sources spell it B-A-A-L, possibly pronounced as Baal. The Akkadian form, Bel, was used in ancient Mesopotamia. Baal, Lord, was the name or title of a number of local deities of ancient Semitic peoples. Baal worship appeared in Syria and Israel many centuries before the birth of Christ, as early as 1400 BC, according to Syrian cuneiform texts. This date is very interesting in light of the 1200 BC Seth mentions for Ron and the conflict within his group over Baal. Baal was most often a god of fertility, its image of stone probably a phallic one. According to Orthodox Israelite belief, Baal, or nature worship, was idolatrous, a denial of any moral values. While we were talking about the city of Mycenae, about which none of us knew anything, Seth returned briefly.
Now, write down R-A-M-A. It is another city. Give us a moment, and then we will indeed say good evening.
Rama is the name of several Palestinian towns and means height in Hebrew. Biblical allusions associate the name with some of the high places of cultic practice. These sites, rejected as immoral and threatening to Israelite belief, contained objects of illegitimate worship, the sacred pillar of Baal being one such. I discovered all of this information through research after the session. None of it was known to us at the time. Resume at 11:48.
In your terms, and in your terms only, the coming of Christ was the second coming.
Pause.
In those terms, and again, this is important, in those terms only, he appeared at the time of Atlantis, but the records were destroyed and forgotten, except in the memory of a few who survived. Now, again, in those terms, he is an entity who appears time and time again within your physical system, but he has been recognized on only two occasions, once in Atlantis and once in the Christ story as it has come down to you in all of its distortions. He appears and reappears, therefore, sometimes making himself known and sometimes not. He was not one personality, as I have told you, but a highly developed entity, sometimes appearing as a fragment of himself. In your terms, he eternally weaves himself within the fabric of your time and space, born again and again into the world of flesh, being part of it while also independent of it, even as you are all a part of it but independent of it. Now, since our little friend over here,
Ron's daughter-in-law, Sherry,
is worried lest I annoy the neighbors, I will smile what I hope is a gentle smile and bid you a gentle good evening with what blessings I have to give.
And at 11:55 p.m., Jane's trance had again been deep, and it took her a while to come out of it. "Wow," she said, "I feel that energy so strongly now going through me, carrying me along." After the session, Ron explained the second coming as given in the Bible in Matthew 24. He also told us about Jesus predicting his own death and resurrection several times in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and of the resulting uncertainty and misunderstanding of the disciples. Even after his crucifixion, the risen Jesus wasn't recognized on various occasions. Jane Roberts, ESP Class Session, Tuesday, January 5, 1971. This session followed a class discussion on reincarnation and probabilities. Seth's comments and the students' questions show the give-and-take characteristic of class sessions and demonstrates their scope.
Now, ancient Rome exists, and so does Egypt and Atlantis. You not only form the future as you think of it, but you also form the past. You have been told simple tales, and they are delightful ones, but if you were not ready to hear more, you would not be in this room. You and your reincarnated selves or personalities are not imprisoned in time. There is a constant interchange going on between what you think of as your present self and your past and future selves. If this were not the case, then I would not be speaking here, for I am not Rupert's past self. Each personality is free. Time has open ends in all directions, or such a thing as probabilities would not exist. Therefore, actions that you make now can help a so-called past personality, and a so-called future personality may step in and help you along your weary way. Also, your actions now can affect the future personality as well as the past one. You must try to stretch your imagination and feel these realities, because the intellect alone cannot comprehend them. Psychological time is your best method for perceiving these actualities. You can feel what you cannot necessarily describe verbally, for you are more than the physical brain that you have now. I am no poet, but as in one of Rupert's poems, think of the brain as a web you form about the inner self. This web work helps you manipulate in a world of space and time, and is as nebulous, precarious, and delicate as any spider's web, and in as precarious a balance. You form this, and then perceive the world, but your viewpoint is very small, and the garden you perceive very intimate. You have, however, far greater abilities of perception. I want you to understand the nature of your inner self, or soul, for it is a focal point of reality from which other realities spring. It is not imprisoned in tiny boxes of days or weeks or months or even of centuries. Now I will let you all take a break, and I will return in a moment.
During a break, Janice S. wanted to know if Seth was a part of Jane's personality.
Now, Rupert cannot answer you as easily as I can. We were originally a portion of the same entity. I evolved along my own ways, and he evolved along his. Therefore, we are both independent.
Janice S. In other words, all parts of the entity are evolving? Are they developing as one?
I evolved to form my own entity. Rupert will also, but he is not at that stage yet, in your terms. In another frame of reference, he is, of course. He also contains those portions of himself that are less developed, for they all exist as one. All the parts of himself are aware of this correspondence. In your terms only, I could be referred to, and I have told Rupert this, as a sixth self of his in his future. But this is only to get the idea across, for he will not become what I am. That is impossible. I am myself. There are certain answers that cannot be given verbally, but must be intuitively understood. Yet the fact that I exist and can communicate should show you in simple terms that other higher aspects of your personality can help you out on occasion.
Janice S., have you always taught on reincarnation?
Teaching has been my main object, but I have not always been a teacher. I was a spice merchant at one time, a round and fat and heavy spice merchant.
Janice S. But handsome, smiling.
I do not know what to do with you. We learned what spices would do long before the present generation got hung up on grass. We got high on the high seas, sniffing oregano.
In the 1600s.
We brought spices to Denmark. We had delightful trips indeed. We explored far down the coast of Africa. I was quite a gourmet. Now, all of your so-called pasts exist within you now, and you can recapture your memories and discover what they are. You are not imprisoned in time unless you believe that you are, and there is nothing more important than belief. If you believe that you exist only within the context of this life, that you are born only to death and annihilation, then you will not use your freedoms in this existence. You deny their abilities when they show themselves, yet no one forces this bondage upon you but yourself. To understand your multidimensional self is to use it.
Janice has commented that Seth did not give many predictions.
I am not cautious. I am simply realistic. When you understand the nature of reality, then you realize that predictions of future events are basically meaningless. You can predict some events, and they can occur, but you create the future in every moment. Time, in your terms, is plastic. Most predictions are made in a highly distorted fashion. They can lead the public astray. Not only that, but when the predictors fall flat on their faces, it does not help the cause. Reality does not exist in that fashion. You can tune into certain probabilities and predict that they will occur, but free will always operates. No god in a giant ivory tower says, "This will happen February 15th at 8:05. And if no god predicts, then I do not see the point of doing so myself.
N.E.G. What about precognitive dreams?
Some are entirely legitimate. Often, however, the suggestion involved in a dream brings about the event. So it seems when the dream becomes real that you have looked into a future that already existed. Instead, you have formed the event, not realizing that it had its origins at the time you slept. The question cannot be answered simply, for there are many ramifications, but from this instant of reality you form and change not only the future, but the past. In the operation of probabilities, this has great significance, for this means that you change and affect all events, and that your books are a delightful fiction that tell you only your current ideas about the past.
Sally W. How can I change my way of thinking to keep my family well instead of making them sick?
Back here, we have a question from the gallery.
Smiling.
You must realize that you do not form events alone. You are involved in a cooperative venture. Usually, then, you alone are not responsible for an event because others participate in its creation for their own reasons. The question cannot be answered simply in one evening, but each consciousness has its own defense system and its own vitality. You should trust your own. You cooperate together to form the physical reality that you know telepathically through ways and means that are unknown to you. You weave webs of psychic reality then that coalesce into physical reality. You do not necessarily weave them alone, but together. Your thoughts intertwine with those of others. You are responsible for your own thoughts. You need to learn the power of thought and emotion, but this should fill you with the joy of creativity. Once you realize that your thoughts form reality, then you are no longer a slave to events. You simply have to learn the methods.
Sally W. But I don't know how to learn them.
You will learn them here. You will learn them through reading and through listening to your inner self. The methods have been known for centuries. Not only centuries as you think of them, but for the lifetime of this earth as you know it, and even before, when the poles were reversed, and when there were other stars in the sky, and when the planets were not the planets that you know. You may take a break.
Terry B. Where did you get the oregano, and in what form did you sniff it?
It was in the Indies, and it was dry.
One of the subjects discussed at break concerned the degree of permanence of the physical human form.
In our own sessions, I have explained something that I haven't mentioned in class, and it is this. For every moment of time that you seem to exist in this universe, you do not exist in it. The atoms and molecules have a pulsating nature that you do not usually perceive, so what seems to you to be a continuous atom or molecule is, instead, a series of pulsations that you cannot keep track of. Physical matter is not permanent. You only perceive it as continuous. Your perceptive mechanisms are not equipped to detect the pulsations. Now I am speaking to our friend over here, Art O, an engineer, because he may perhaps have a comprehension of what I am trying to explain because of his background.
Art O. Are these pulses extremely fast in our terms?
They are indeed. In certain conditions, however, the inner self, abandoning its usual reliance upon the physical senses, is aware of these periods that would seem to you to be negations. Your consciousness fluctuates in the same way. It is here, and then it is not here. But the physical self focuses upon only those moments of physical reality. Because consciousness fluctuates, however, other portions of yourself have memory of those times when it is not focused in physical reality, and this is also a portion of your entire existence. This isn't half as complicated as it sounds. Whether or not you remember your dreams, for example, a certain portion of you, under hypnosis, could remember every dream that you ever had in your life. So, a certain portion of you remembers those non-moments when you are not focused in physical reality, when your existence is in another dimension of actuality entirely, and you are perceiving what I will call, in your term of reference, non-intervals. I like the term non-intervals better than non-moments.
Art O. Is this non-interval a moment of this existence?
It is indeed in this existence, and also non-intervals are moments in other dimensions of reality.
Jim H. Might this be compared to the rotating light in a lighthouse?
It may, if you like the analogy.
Art O. The analogy I get is of an electromagnetic wave, a carrier wave, and it's rectified. The intervals are the positive pulses, and the non-intervals are the negative pulses.
This is why I was talking to you.
Art O. Are there more than two pulses?
There are, and the whole self is aware of all of these realities. With no unkindness meant, you all know yourselves and your weaknesses and failures, so why should you suppose that the self you know is the only self that you are? Surely it has occurred to you that you have abilities you are not using, that other realities connected with your innermost existence aren't being expressed in the existence you know of.
To Art O.
I want you to think about the implications of what I have said concerning non-intervals.
Jim H. Would a non-interval be a positive interval to another aspect of our existence?
It is, and they would not perceive your existence here, for to them it would be a non-interval.
Jim H. Could this be the key to the simultaneous existence of all of our lives, the key to non-time?
Yes, indeed. And some evening I will tell you that you should change your conception of the word lives. This is the first hint I have given, either in our private sessions or in class, of some rather important material. But think of what you mean when you use the word lives, and see how limited the term is. I am going to end our session, but I have a comment. I have said this before. You are as dead now as you will ever be. Now, if you understand that remark and think about it, you will understand much that is behind what I have said this evening.
Art O. Then we are as alive now as we have ever been?
That is correct. Except that in the life in which you are now involved, you are not focusing upon the full potential of your vitality.
Janice S. Was there a continent of Mu?
There was. Now, I tell you to remember your dreams. In your context, I will tell you again not only to remember your dreams, but to learn to come awake in the middle of them and realize that you can manipulate within them. You form them. They are yours, not something thrust upon you in which you are powerless.
Janice S. We are using our existence as the dream?
What I have said applies to what you just said. In one context, what you call physical reality is a dream, but in a larger context, it is a dream that you have created. When you realize that you form it, you come into the memory of your whole self. And when you realize that you form the events of your life in the same way, you will learn to take hold of your entire consciousness in whatever aspect it shows itself in this life. Through all of this, you must realize that you are not powerless. Remember also that this life is a dimension of experience and reality, even if it is, in contrast, a dream in a higher level of reality in which you have your larger consciousness.
Jane Roberts ESP Class Session, Tuesday, January 12, 1971. The first part of the session concerned a class member and her reluctance to look deeper within herself.
Very nicely, in class, she personifies the feelings that each of you have to some degree involving your inner self. She shows her feelings in an exaggerated fashion for you to look at, and so when she speaks, it is not only for herself, but for everyone in this room, including Rupert.
To the member.
You have indeed been performing a useful service in class, but I expect to see it changed. For when you begin to look within yourself, you will set the others a fine example, and so you shall.
During break, Jane read excerpts from some material concerning Gnosticism. This was followed by a discussion of the data Seth introduced in last week's class session concerning the pulsating nature of atoms and molecules. And this in turn led to the consideration of possible origins for the so-called flying saucer phenomena.
One small note. In some respects, these pulsations represent what happens in some of your flying saucer incidents, for you do not have a vehicle such as the one you think you perceive. I am speaking of only certain cases where you have visitors from other realities. What happens is that you have an attempt to exchange camouflage realities. The beings entering your plane cannot appear within it as themselves. Since their atomic structure is not the same as yours, distortions must occur in order to make any contact possible. Thus, you are greeted with a certain set of sense data. You then try to figure out what is happening, but the sense data you see means that the event is already distorted. To some degree. The physical vehicles that are often perceived are your interpretation of the event that is actually occurring. Our friend back here,
Paul W.,
could well appear, you see, as a UFO in another aspect of reality and frighten the inhabitants. You forget that consciousness is the only true vehicle. No part of your consciousness is imprisoned within you. It materializes in one aspect or another. I use the word materializes because it makes sense to you, but it is distortive since it predisposes an appearance within matter. Yet all realities, as you know, are not physical. It is theoretically possible, for example, for any of you to disperse your consciousness and become a part of any object in the room, or to fly apart, to disperse yourself out into space, without leaving your sense of identity. This is not practical, in your terms, yet many of you do it to gain refreshment while you are sleeping. Consciousness, by its very characteristics, carries the burden of perception. This is the kind of consciousness you are used to thinking of. You cannot imagine it without perception in your terms, and yet consciousness can be vital and alive without your idea of perception. The last part of that sentence is very important.
To Art O.
Now, my dear scientific friend over there, atoms and molecules, minute as they may appear to you, also carry their burden of consciousness and responsibility. Yet there is a portion of consciousness that can joyfully perceive in a manner that is not dictated by its nature. It can playfully perceive as a creative aspect of its being without responsibility. In one manner of speaking, the very air about you sings with its own joyful consciousness. It does not know the same kind of burden of consciousness that often oppresses you.
Speaking generally,
you are so frightened of death in your terms that you dare not turn your consciousness off for 1 second, for fear that if you do, indeed, who will be there to turn it back on again?
Art O. Is the whole entity involved in this dispersion of consciousness, or just the portion of it we know now?
It is the way that galaxies form. It is the way that the universe expands, and it is the way that entities form. Now, that is your answer. Chew that one over for a while. I am pleased because you are thinking this evening, all of you. That is what I want you to do. Ideas have no reality unless you make them your own. Make friends or enemies of them. Fight with them or love them, but use and experience them, not only with your intellect, but with your feelings.
Bert C. spoke of relating to oneself and to others.
Until you are honest with yourself and become consciously aware of yourself, you cannot honestly relate with others. You will project upon them your own fears and prejudices. You cannot afford to help them because you have too many insecurities within yourself. Now, you form the physical reality that you know individually and en masse. To change your world, you must change your thoughts. You must become consciously aware of what you tell yourself is true every moment of the day, for that is the reality that you project outward.
Bert C. It sounds like a lifelong task just to work out the first half of that before you can begin to relate to others.
It is indeed. However, telepathy does exist. Others are aware then to a large extent of what you are thinking and feeling.
Bert C. My true feelings, despite what I might project consciously?
The true feelings do not necessarily imply the violent or aggressive feelings. They also imply the feelings of love and acceptance that are buried beneath your own fears and those you are terrified of expressing in physical reality.
Bert C. I think I understand, then, that all of these different levels of my consciousness are being communicated, not only by me consciously, but also telepathically.
That is true. When you project your ideas outward, you often behave as if they were not yours, but belonged to another. Therefore, it behooves you to understand what your ideas and feelings are, and not be frightened of them.
Jim H., told of finding a man asleep at his work. Jim explained his ideas and emotions concerning the incident and wanted to know how he could change them.
You can indeed change them, but do not deny the part of you that wanted to wring the other man's neck. You were so frightened of the thought that you immediately inhibited it. Let us consider. You are terrified of the idea that evil is more powerful than good, that one stray violent thought of yours was more important and powerful than the vitality of good. At least you were aware of the thought. Now, say the following happened, that in your terms you progressed to the point where you were no longer aware of the feeling.
Jim H. You don't just automatically think good things about this fellow and repress the negative thoughts without becoming aware of what you felt.
Of course, so your muscles tensed, your adrenaline production increased. You wanted to wring his neck, but you said, God bless you, my fine young fellow, may you live a long and merry life. Telepathically, our fine young fellow knew exactly what you were feeling. You were out of contact with your feelings. At this point of your spiritual progression, you only imagined that you wished him good. The muscles were already contracted in your body because you did not admit your true feelings. Now, 3 weeks later, we have another encounter. Our poor, ignorant workman again falls asleep at his chores. Our good minister comes by. He sees the idle one upon the floor, snoozing, and he thinks, I would like to kick you in the you-know-where. But then, oh no, I cannot think such an unchristian thought. Violence is wrong. So before he admits to himself what he feels, hiding any acknowledgement of aggression, he bends down and says, My good man, may you live long and heartily. God bless your life. He pats himself upon the back and thinks, I am growing more spiritual day by day. In the meantime, his muscles have contracted 10 times because they could not be put into activity, as the thought behind them was denied. Our poor man is again subconsciously aware of the intent, but only to some degree. 3 months later, you have a really bad day. You are mad at life in general, and now you find our friend upon the floor again. This time, perhaps, he is asleep at a somewhat more important chore that you wanted done. Now, far be it from me to accuse you of such an act, even in a fantasy. But this time you are out of your mind. Again, it behooves you to deny your true feelings in order to be spiritual, which is not true spirituality, and you say again, God bless you, may you go in peace. This time the psychic safety valve has had too much. The nicest thing that could happen would be that you suddenly blew your stack and kicked him. The worst thing that could happen would be that once again you restrain the acknowledgement of the pent-up, perfectly natural aggression that is now ready to explode. So you send out a thought form out of all proportion to any of the events that have transpired. The thought form causes your friend severe harm. And all of this because you were afraid that one stray aggressive thought of yours was more powerful than the vitality that resides in each of you.
Jim H. In the beginning, before we compounded the frustration and the emotional charges, would you have recommended an action like saying, Come on, this is wrong. I've probably done this sort of thing myself, but it really bugs me. We have to get up and get to work here. Would being honest with him at that level have prevented these charges?
Yes. The most important thing, however, is to acknowledge the feeling as legitimate, with its own realm of existence, to admit it as a part of yourself. Then choose how you want to deal with it. You do not make others the brunt of your anger. Anger is merely a method of communication.
Jim H. I don't want to direct the brunt of my anger at either of us. One, I don't want to kick him. Two, I don't want to hurt myself in some way.
Originally, you were not angry enough to kick him. The thought existed, but it wasn't strong enough to bring about the physical reaction even if you had fully admitted it. Do you follow me?
Jim H. Yes, I want to learn how to handle such feelings without trying to repress them.
You should, first of all, admit that the feelings exist as a part of yourself at the ego level. Whenever you close your feelings off from yourself, you are, in your terms, less alive. Then, as far as is possible, communicate those feelings verbally in whatever way you choose. Use anger as a method of communication. Often it will lead to results that you do not think of, and beneficial ones. You certainly understand that I am doing with your case the same thing that I have done with others, so please do not be offended. I do not want any of you, you see, to use these ideas as superficial bandages for your bleeding psyches, so you are not as bad as I pegged you. You might be inclined in the direction I have indicated, but then so is everyone else in the room, including Rupert.
Jim H. Now, would you define bad in that context?
I do not define bad. When I use the term, it is according to your own definition. You have an idea that good is gentle and bad is violent. This is because in your mind, violence and destruction are the same thing. By this analogy, you see, the soft voice is the holy voice and the loud voice is the wicked one. And a strong desire is the bad desire, and a weak desire the good one. You become afraid of projecting ideas or desires outward, for in the back of your mind you think that what is powerful is evil. Instead, I am telling you that the universe is a good universe. It knows its own vitality, and that vitality is within you. You can encourage it freely. Your own nature is a good nature, and you can trust it. Because something is difficult does not mean it is good.
Jim H. The first night I was here, you said, "We will see more of you." You were quite definitive about it. I've often wondered, why the certainty?
Because I knew why you had come here, and I knew your wife would come also. I am not saying there is no free will. I am simply making a statement about this realm of probabilities.
Jim H. To me, that implies a prior knowledge of our lives.
It does, indeed, in your terms, but that knowledge is also available to you. Now, we cannot cover one topic clearly in a single evening, much less 101 topics. In reference, however, to one remark you made earlier, you have in almost all of your lives been strongly involved in what you would call religious endeavors. Your remaining lives were just as religiously involved in opposite endeavors in your terms, but we will go into that later. The holy soul turned inside out is some fleshpot, let's put it that way. You have always been involved with questions concerning good and evil, and you had two existences in two civilizations in Egypt. In one of these, your friend over here,
Bert C.,
was involved. It is too late to go into that incarnation this evening, and besides, neither of you are ready to benefit from it yet. It is not a fascinating story to be told only for your enjoyment, but it will help when you can understand it. I am much more concerned with the reaction of all of you to the material that Rupert read this evening.
On Gnosticism.
Now, if it seems to you that one class member is monopolizing a session, then remember what I have said before. The questions spoken by one are the unspoken questions of many. It has seemed to many of you that you have been tinged by evil from birth.
To Jim H.
In one of your past lives, you not only heartily believed this, but taught it. As Rupert would put it, your sidekick over here,
Jim's wife, Jean,
did not go along with your ideas at all in that life. She was a male at that time, however, and you were a female and a priestess. So was your friend,
Bert C.
As a male in that life, she had an expanding effect upon your personality, but you were very given to ritual and a belief in magic acts, and to the idea that existence in itself was evil and wrong. You were indeed a member of the sect now called Gnostic.
Gnosticism was a selected system of religion and philosophy, uniting features of Platonism, Orientalism, Christianity, and dualism. It embraced pre-Christian times and later and took several forms. In all of them, its central doctrine held that knowledge, gnosis, was the means of salvation from the tyranny of matter, more than philosophy or faith. Jim H. Is that why I react so strongly against Gnosticism now, because I've gone beyond that point?
Not only that, but because you sense in yourself still some sympathy toward the beliefs. While you are freeing yourself, you recognize within your psyche a leaning in that direction, and so you lash out whenever you hear such ideas, not realizing that you lash out against yourself.
Kathy B. Is that why I have a similar reaction to this Gnostic literature?
You were at that time a male and a friend of his. Now, almost all who come to these classes have at one time or another been engaged in such endeavors. You have all been a part of other classes, though not necessarily with me. Because of your long interest, certain aspects will hit many of you very strongly. Association operates not only within one life, but between lives, in your terms. Words and phrases spoken now will trigger your memories, and those memories will become alive if you allow them to.
To Art O.
Even our African god over there can remember his past lives if he will only allow himself to do so.
Art O. Is that life the reason why I like African music now?
It is one of the reasons. The other reason has to do with another life in which you were musically inclined. Now, I am going to bid you all a fond good evening.
To Mary M.
I have one message for our friend over here, however, and it is quite simple. When you do not know what to do, relax and tell yourself that other portions of yourself do know. They will take over. Give yourself some rest. Remind yourself that in many ways you are a very successful person as you are. Success does not necessarily involve great intellect or great position or great wealth. It has to do with inner integrity. Remember that. I bid you all now a fond good evening.
Jane Roberts ESP Class Session, Tuesday, February 9th, 1971. This session also contained the very interesting material that Seth gave concerning his own perceptions while he is addressing a group of people. That data is quoted in the 575th session in Chapter 19.
Now, I do have something to say to this one,
Sue W.
And that one,
Jim H.
And to some extent to all of you. There is no need to justify your existence. You do not need to write or preach to justify yourselves, for instance. Being is its own justification. Only when you realize this can you begin to utilize your freedom, otherwise you try too hard. This also applies to our friend Rupert. If you become too determined to justify your existence, then you will begin to close out areas of your life. Only those areas that mean safe justification to you will have meaning, and the others will begin to disappear. You do not have to justify in any terms. Now, if you would each, for 10 minutes a day, open yourselves to your own reality, there would be no question of self-justification, for you would realize the miraculous nature of your own identity. I have said this before in class. You are as dead now and as alive as you will ever be. In life, you can be as dead as you think any corpse is, even by contrast far deader. When I come here to speak, I focus my energy, but not toward this room as a destination, for in your terms, this room does not exist to me. In your terms, this room does not even exist to you. You pretend to agree that it does. We meet in no place of space or time. The true meetings that take place here have nothing to do with the room or the people that you think you are. You know that you hallucinate the room, that you are as much in trance here as you ever are when you are in psychological time. I simply want you to realize that if this life is a trance, then you can turn the direction of your consciousness to perceive greater realities that presently exist. You can be aware of your own greater identity, even as I am. You sit within the miracle of yourselves and ask for signs. It is your inner eyes I would open. As you know yourselves, you only accept those suggestions, ideas, and hang-ups that suit your purposes at this time. You are not, therefore, at the mercy of any neurosis from a past life, nor are there any fears from your present lives that you cannot conquer. I have not said that you will necessarily conquer them, but it is within your ability to do so. The decision is your own, according to your understanding. You cannot be hounded from one level of reality to another by a fear that you do not understand. You cannot be threatened in this life by fears from your early childhood or by so-called past experiences unless you so thoroughly believe in the nature of fear that you allow yourselves to be conquered by it. Each of your personalities are free to accept and develop from the miraculous banks of reality those experiences and emotions that you want, and to reject those that you do not want. Let me give you a more concrete example that each of you can use in your own way. Suppose the worst, that in this life you have the following background. You are poor. You are of a minority race. You are not intellectual. You are a woman. You have a severe physical defect, and you are no beauty. Now, you set these challenges for yourself in a so-called past life. This does not mean that you cannot use all of your courage and resolution to solve these problems. You set them in the hope that you will solve them. You did not set them like millstones about your neck, hoping ahead of time that you would drown. All you have to do is realize your own freedom. You form the reality that you know, not esoterically, not symbolically, not philosophically. Some great oversoul doesn't form it for you. You cannot put the burden there either. You have, in the past, collectively and individually, blamed a god or a fate for the nature of your personal realities, those aspects, indeed, that you did not like. The personality is given the greatest gift of all. You get exactly what you want to get. You create from nothing the experience that is your own. If you do not like your experience, then look within yourself and change it. But realize also that you are responsible for your joys and triumphs, and that the energy to create any of these realities comes from the inner self. What you do with it is up to the individual personality.
During break, class members discussed fate and predestination.
Some evening, I would like our lady over here to talk to me about predestination.
Bernice M. I would like you to talk to me about it.
You are not programmed. Nothing happens because it must happen. Every thought that you have now changes reality, not only reality as you know it, but all reality. No act of yours predisposes a future self to act in a particular manner. There are banks of activity from which you can draw or choose not to draw.
Bernice M. Do we make instantaneous decisions? For example, I was thinking of the Los Angeles earthquake today. A man walked out into the street and was killed by a falling brick. What made this one person in the entire building walk out?
This particular individual was quite aware of what would occur on what you would call an unconscious basis. He was not predestined to die. He chose both the time in your terms and the method for reasons of his own.
Bernice M. Regardless of who chose, it was destined that he die.
It was not predestined. He chose. No one chose for him.
Bernice M. But he had made the decision before.
Before when?
Bernice M. Before he was killed.
He knew that he was ready to go on to other spheres of activity. Unconsciously, he looked about for the means and chose those immediately available. This particular individual, 3 days earlier, had made the plan. There was no predestination involved. Because a tree branch falls, this does not mean that it was destined to fall in either the particular manner of its fall, nor in the timing of the fall. There is a great difference between free choice and predestination.
Jim H. Didn't you say earlier, referring to the woman who was born in a minority race, that her challenges had been set up by a previous personality, in our terms?
By the whole self.
Jim H. The decision was made when that previous personality had returned to the whole self for a period of re-evaluation?
You must realize again that we are speaking of divisions for convenience's sake, where none really exists. At the same time, so to speak, that this personality is born into a minority race, in a completely different era, it may be born rich, secure, and aristocratic. It is searching out different methods of experience and expansion. Do you follow me?
Jim H. I understand. I thought you probably meant the challenges had been set up by the whole self.
Indeed. Remember, this is your entire identity of which we are speaking. It is only you who are presently aware of but one portion of it, and this portion you insist upon calling yourself. You are the self who makes these decisions.
Bert C. What recourse would the poor individual who was born with all of these seemingly insurmountable handicaps have, were she to say consciously at the ego level, I just don't want any of this. I would have much preferred to have been born aristocratic.
The inner self realizes, however, that potentials are present that would not necessarily be present under other circumstances. Abilities that can not only help the present personality, but other individuals, and even society at large. Your main point of contention is brought about by the emotional barriers that are caused by the difference in terms. It is as if you choose to work for a day in the slums. It would be ridiculous for you to choose to do this and then say to yourself, why did I choose to work in the slums? I would prefer to work on Fifth Avenue. You know the reason, and your entire identity knows the reason. You hide it from the present self simply to ensure the fact that the present reality is not a pretended one. A rich man who tries to be poor for a day to learn what poverty is learns little, because he cannot forget the wealth that is available to him. Though he eats the same poor fare as the poor man and lives in the same poor house for a day, or for a year, or 5 years, he knows he has his mansion to return to. So you hide these things from yourself so that you can relate. You forget your home so that you can return to it enriched. Consciousness is not made up of balances so much as it is made up of exquisite imbalances, and the focus of awareness is to some degree the result of this state of excitability. In this state, all elements are never known because new ones are always being created. I am not speaking of physical elements, but of the psychological characteristics of consciousness, for even those continually merge and change. You are not now what you were 10 minutes earlier. You are not the same being physically, psychologically, spiritually, or psychically, and 10 minutes later you will be different again. To deny this is to try to force consciousness into some rigid form from which it cannot ever be freed, to apply rules to it that make a very neat psychological landscape.
Now Seth's voice really began to boom out.
Now I would like you again to realize the energy that is available. If Rupert can use it, you can each use it in your own way. I want you to open up those barriers that you have erected within yourselves. This voice is only used as a symbol of the energy and the strength that is available to each of you as you utilize those abilities that are your heritage. You should hear your own echo of my voice as a symbol of your own energy and joy. Forget the cringing selves that you sometimes are, and remember instead the magic essence of your own being that sings even now through your fingertips. That is the reality which you are seeking. Experience it fully. Do you need an old dead thing like me to tell you what life is? I should be ashamed. Now, I bid you a fond good evening, and those blessings that are mine to give, I give you. Travel in peace and joy and safety in your bodies and out.
About the author. Jane Roberts, May 8, 1929 to September 5, 1984, grew up in Saratoga Springs, New York, where she attended Skidmore College. Jane was a prolific writer in a variety of genres, including poetry, short stories, children's literature, fiction, and nonfiction. Her international best-selling nonfiction books include Seth Speaks, The Nature of Personal Reality, The Nature of the Psyche, and The Individual and the Nature of Mass Events. Her enormously popular novels include The Education of Oversoul 7, The Further Education of Oversoul 7, and Oversoul 7 and the Museum of Time, now published as the Oversoul 7 Trilogy. Yale University Library maintains a collection of Jane's writings, journals, poetry, and audio and video recordings that were donated after her death by her husband, Robert F. Butts. For further information, contact New Awareness Network, Inc., 516-869-9108, between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Sumari, S-U-M-A-R-I, at sethcenter.com, or visit our websites, www.sethcenter.com, www.sethlearningcenter.org, www.sethconference.org.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Seth Speaks, The Eternal Validity of the Soul, by Jane Roberts, with notes and cover art by Robert F. Butts, performed by Braden Wright, Donna Postel, and Mel Foster. Copyright 1972 by Jane Roberts. Copyright 1994 by Robert F. Butts. Copyright 2012 by Laurel Davies. Performance copyright 2018 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.